You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
After the first Gulf War, the United States flooded the Iraqi economy with counterfeit dinars to undermine Saddam Hussein. Today, the Treasury Department uses a much larger arsenal of financial tactics to counter terrorist networks, criminal organizations, rogue regimes, and other threats. During the George W. Bush administration, as the first Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Terrorist Financing and Financial Crimes, Juan Zarate was part of a small group of Treasury officials who developed these tactics, and now a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, the senior national security analyst for CBS News, and a visiting lecturer of law at Harvard Law School, Mr. Zarate has written a book called Treasury's War, The Unleashing of a New Era of Financial Warfare. It's published by Public Affairs, and I'm very pleased that it brings Juan Zarate to our show today. Hello.
Hi, Leonard.
Before we address the main issues that you write about in this book, can we talk a bit about the current situation in Syria?
Absolutely.
You were quoted in yesterday's New York Times in regard to how the Assads accumulated their stockpile of chemical weapons. And although many countries condemned Syria for adding to its arsenal as nations were eliminating their own, few challenged the buildup and some were even eager to profit from it. You were quoted as saying it was frustrating. People tried. There were always other understandably urgent priorities, Iran's nuclear program, North Korea. It was an issue that was always there but never rose to the top of the world's agenda.
Yeah, and I think that's right, Leonard. I think the frustrating part, and it's endemic in the context of the regime in Damascus. There are so many problems attendant to it. Keep in mind that Damascus has been a bit of a crossroads for nefarious actors, the home of a lot of terrorist organizations that the U.S. worries about, sanctions evasion with respect to Iraq, a nuclear program that they were developing with the North Koreans. And so this is a regime that has presented a whole host of problems for the U.S. and the world community. The chemical stockpiles have been just one of many problems, and I think getting the world's attention on that as they built up those stockpiles has been difficult.
Well, hasn't it recently been revealed that Great Britain allowed the export to Syria of substances that were used to make chemical weapons? Well, would the United States have been aware of that?
Well, I'm not sure. Perhaps. I think what you had were a series of companies throughout Europe and elsewhere that were providing material perhaps directly to Syria. Often what happens, and this makes chemical weapons all the more difficult to prevent, is you have precursors that have dual use, can be used for manufacturing, for other chemical purposes.
Pesticides.
Pesticides, exactly, but can also then be retweaked or re-engineered by scientists, like the scientists in the Syrian program, for nefarious purposes. And so that makes it very difficult. It's a little bit like biological weaponry when you have some pathogens and agents, and also nuclear programs where you have dual-use items that can be used for the development of nuclear programs or for more innocuous commercial activity.
Russia has reportedly been flowing tons of currency into Syria. Can the United States even respond to something like that?
Well, it's difficult. I think what Syria is reacting to and why you see Russia flowing money in, the Iranians as well, is the fact that the Syrian economy has grown more and more isolated over the years. The banking system in particular, but also its commercial activities, that also follows with what has happened with Iran. We've had a constriction campaign underway to really isolate Iran's ability to do business abroad, to make them pariahs in the international financial commercial markets. And that has led to this kind of isolation.
But you say that despite the sanctions, they still are capable of sending money into Syria.
No, that's right.
So are the sanctions having much of an impact?
They are having an impact. And all you have to do is listen to what they say about the effects. Certainly the Iranian leadership has talked about it. The Syrian leadership has said the same. But you're right. These aren't foolproof measures. You can't ziplock bag a jurisdiction from getting money and from finding outlets. And I think the key here is if a country like Syria has a financial outlet like Russia, it provides a lifeline, just like North Korea with China. If there is a commercial and financial lifeline, it makes the sanctions much less effective and much harder to implement. It doesn't mean that they shouldn't be implemented. It doesn't mean that they can't be effective. But it does mean that you have to then deal with Russia and China to try to tighten up those lifelines for those regimes.
We've heard a lot about new American military technology and techniques, drones, less than lethal weapons using sound or microwaves, and, of course, electronic surveillance like the stuff that's being used by the NSA or the CIA. What are the tools or weapons of financial warfare?
Well, they aren't quite as flash bang, as you'd say, but they are very interesting and in many ways accelerated and developed after 9/11. What you had in particular from the Treasury Department was a more aggressive use of financial intelligence, information that the Treasury Department gets by law from the banking community, non-bank financial institutions, also working with the intelligence community to develop a whole new discipline known as financial intelligence, trying to follow financial footprints, following the money to find out where terrorist groups and operatives are working. But more importantly, Leonard, it was a recognition that we could use our power as the central sort of financial capital, New York being the core of that, and the role of the dollar as a global currency to our immediate benefit, to leverage that to isolate those who want to do business in the U.S. and who want to do business with the legitimate financial community.
But we're calling it financial, not economic warfare?
Yes. The reason I do that is because the principal cornerstone sort of theory behind this is that you isolate regimes, organizations, access to financing, access to the banking system first and foremost. It then translates into economic blockades and warfare as the dial is turned up. But in the first instance, and the real trick here in the post 9/11 period was to recognize the banks were the seminal part of the system that needed to be enlisted and needed to be restricted in terms of their providing financing for rogue regimes and organizations.
Do major financial institutions and others have strong interests in whatever financial tactics the U.S. uses? Haven't we heard of any number of them secretly going against the rules?
Yeah. No, there's clearly been a number of cases. I think the emblematic case, certainly in Washington, was the fall of Riggs Bank, once called the most important bank and the most important capital in the world, after a very meager anti-money laundering sanction basically fell because of the reputational weight and cost of those sanctions. And that bank is no more.
But that hasn't happened to Barclays. And
no, you're right. You're right. And this is a challenge for the system, no doubt. The challenge is, how do you get the major banking institutions, those that provide facilities around the world, to not only provide the kind of compliance and prophylactic measures, but so that they really are the guardians at the gate of the financial system. I think for the most part that has worked, but you've had no doubt efforts by some in the banking world to profit, and that's where you've seen them slip up.
And didn't you once work for HSBC when they were caught to be laundering some money? Was it drug money?
No, I didn't work for HSBC then. Oh. I do work for them now as an advisor. I was brought in after the fact to help them get out from under their problems, to remediate the problems, and to make sure that they never get into trouble again.
My guest is Juan C. Zarate, Z-A-R-A-T-E. His book, Treasury's War, The Unleashing of a New Era of Financial Warfare. You were the first to head the Office of Terrorist Financing and Financial Crimes. That office is part of the Treasury Office of Terrorism and Financial Intelligence. Was that created after 9/11?
It was. Leonard, it's actually one of the revampings of the bureaucracy in Washington that people probably don't know too much about, and the book gets into a bit of this restructuring. When the president, President Bush at the time, decided to create the Department of Homeland Security, what happened was the denuding of the old Treasury Enforcement, the loss of the Secret Service, the loss of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the loss of the Customs Service. And so really all the guns and badges, the core of Treasury Enforcement, were gone. So the question was, what does the Treasury become? What should it be? And that's what we created. We created a new office, the Office of Terrorism and Financial Intelligence, to focus on the use of Treasury tools to isolate rogue behavior.
Is this different than what the Treasury did with Al Capone way back when, getting him on tax evasion rather than as a gangster?
Great question, because the one element of guns and badges, as I like to say, that was left in the Treasury Department were the IRS criminal investigators. So that's the one part that remained. Those were, in essence, I mean, it was tax charges. So those were, in essence, the investigators who went after Al Capone. But what we did in the post 9/11 period was to broaden the approach, to say, look, you not only use law enforcement tools, you not only use regulations, you not only use sanctions, but you use financial diplomacy and suasion and intelligence to do this. And so we built for the first time ever the first intelligence an analytic shop within any finance ministry in the world in this office. We built robust systems and strategies around using financial tools. And we were driving the international agenda on this.
Well, you're a lawyer. Have you had any special training in finance?
Some in law school, but none before actually joining the Treasury Department in August 2001. So I was very fortunate to be placed there at a time when, in some ways, we needed all hands on deck, and I was happy to be there. I had come from the Justice Department, where I'd been a terrorism prosecutor, and so that certainly gave me a grounding in how Al-Qaeda was operating because I'd worked on some of those cases.
A New York Times report indicated that it was the CIA that smuggled counterfeit dinars into Iraq in 1992. What is the Treasury Department doing that's different from what the CIA has done or may still be doing?
Well, I think the Treasury Department, in terms of looking at currency, has actually tried to ensure that counterfeit U.S. dollars are not proliferating. The best example of that was the work that the Secret Service, FBI, and Treasury did along with the State Department to go after what's called the supernote, North Korea's development of, frankly, the most sophisticated counterfeit on earth. It's counterfeit of U.S. $100 bills. These have shown up everywhere from East Asia to Yemen to Peru. And so we've done as much as possible, including sanctioning the banks that have allowed those kinds of bills to be deposited.
Well, how is that any different from us using that as a tactic?
Well, I can't speak for what happened before my tenure and certainly can't speak to classified stuff. But I will tell you, you know, it was not part of our program to inject counterfeit. That wasn't what we were doing. And in fact, what we were trying to do was to make sure that U.S. counterfeit dollars were not proliferating. That, of course, undermines the faith and confidence in the U.S. dollar, and that becomes a systemic problem in the long term if it's not addressed.
Are you going after countries specifically, or are the networks that finance terrorists the leading targets for the Treasury Department's efforts?
It's a great question, Leonard. It's a network-based approach. I think one of the things that looking at the world through the illicit finance lens allows you to do is to look at the networks that are supporting the groups that are a threat to the United States. And those aren't neatly categorized. Sometimes you find overlap between these groups. You see support elements, whether they be financial institutions, front companies, tax attorneys, accountants. And so you have to look at this as a network, because if you stop at the border of a country, you're going to miss the money flows and links that matter.
And we're also talking about organized crime, and we're talking about drug dealers. But could a large business also be a target? For example, a financial institution like Goldman Sachs, which has been investigated for allegedly manipulating aluminum prices around the world.
Absolutely. And you've seen financial companies and sectors come under investigation, both from law enforcement and in terms of sanctions. I think one of the interesting things that happened post 9/11, Leonard, was when President Bush signed the executive order that allowed the Secretary of the Treasury to freeze assets of those supporting terrorism, it wasn't just, you know, go freeze bin Laden's assets. It actually allowed the Secretary of the Treasury to go after those who were financially facilitating. That meant potentially the banks, the non-bank financial institutions, and the brokers who were helping. And that sent a very clear message that we were looking not just at the terrorist groups, but those that were supporting them.
My guess is Juan C. Zarate, who served as deputy assistant to the president and deputy national security advisor for combating terrorism, first ever assistant secretary of the Treasury for terrorist financing and financial crimes. He's written a book called Treasury's War, The Unleashing of a New Era of Financial Warfare. It's published by Public Affairs. We'll continue our conversation after this. We are back with Juan C. Zarate. His book, Treasury's War, The Unleashing of a New Era of Financial Warfare, published by Public Affairs. Haven't nations engaged in economic and financial warfare for centuries? You note that Athens attempted to engage in economic or financial warfare against the allies of Sparta in the lead-up to the Peloponnesian War.
That's right. The Megarian Decree, as they called it.
That's 2,400 years ago?
Yeah. And there have been forms of economic and financial warfare ever since. Blockades. The Civil War saw replete with counterfeit dollar bills. That's actually why Abraham Lincoln created the Secret Service, to go after the counterfeit rings.
And we counterfeited the Confederate money.
Exactly.
As well,
and so, since the dawn of conflict, you've had the use of financial tools and economic warfare as a part of the toolkit. I think what I try to tell in this story is where this falls in the continuum and how the U.S. government has been, I think, very effective in using the role of the dollar, the role of U.S. markets to really influence on issues of national security import.
Now, during the Civil War, a Philadelphia shopkeeper, Samuel Curtis Upham, printed so-called facsimiles of Confederate money. If someone in the United States wanted to undermine, let's say, Iran by printing Iranian currency, how would the United States respond? Would that be considered an illegal act?
It's a good question. I would need to go and look at the, Title 18 and make sure I saw the code. But, counterfeiting any currency, I think, would fall under the criminal statutes. I don't think anyone would recommend anybody do that as a first order. And the problem, too, is somebody who's likely counterfeiting rials from Iran likely has the plates and capabilities to counterfeit other things. And so they would probably fall under some degree of scrutiny, even if it doesn't fall under the letter of the law.
A listener, Michael from Queens, asks, what should be done to banks that allow funding to be directed to terrorists? Because right now we haven't seen too many prosecutions in that area.
So it's a great question. I think those that are found to be witting, where you have a bank that's complicit, either controlled by an organization or actually witting in doing so, should face severe sanctions. That can be monetary. It could be criminal. I think it depends on how the authorities review the facts and the law, but I think they need to be sanctioned to the highest order because you have to have a deterrent impact on the market. And as I talk about in the book, we're talking about a financial ecosystem. The ecosystem itself and the power of what we did was to say, look, the private sector has to have a clear role and incentive here. Reputational risk has to be the coin of the realm that drives these actions. The one thing I would say, though, Leonard, is we may reach a tipping point because if we are not careful about how we sanction banks, you could find a situation where you are denuding the international banking and commercial system of good banking actors who are deciding just not to do business in at-risk jurisdictions or with at-risk customers. And that's being filled by less scrupulous, more nefarious actors. And I call this sort of the alliance of financial rogues. So there's a balance here because we want people to be included in the system. And to a certain extent, you need good banks to do that.
And then there's a traditional system for sending money within much of the Muslim world that has worked perfectly well and often legitimately. But it's impossible to figure out when the money is being sent legally or illegally.
Not wholly impossible. One of the things I do in the book, I try to demystify hawala or hundi, which are the terms for the more traditional ways of moving money. It's basically moving money between brokers, kind of a more traditional Western Union.
I give money to you. You call your friend
Your broker friend in Peshawar,
Cairo,
and make sure the money gets to my mom or my brother on this day. Very efficient, low cost. It gives people access to an international sort of system if they don't have a bank account or an ATM nearby, and has been incredibly effective. And I think one of the things we did, despite the public perception, was not try to destroy the system, but try to find ways of regulating it, because the system actually does have record keeping. These brokers care quite a bit about keeping good records, so they keep good records. They have to interact with banking institutions or bank-like institutions at a certain point to regulate their records and the relationships with other brokers who are in other countries. And so there are ways of monitoring it, and there are ways of enlisting, as we did in Afghanistan, the actual unions that self-regulate, the Hawaladar unions. Believe it or not, there are these unions. And they don't want bad things happening either, for the most part. They don't want to come under undue scrutiny. So The trick is, how do you make it inclusive and how do you regulate it? And that's difficult, but it's not impossible.
At the end of 2011, Daniel Glazer, now Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Terrorist Financing, spoke on the Treasury Department's response to the Arab Spring. Has the U.S. intervened financially to support or oppose any of the competing factions in some of the countries that have been experiencing unrest, Egypt, Tunisia, Bahrain?
Well, what you've seen, I think, the Treasury do is use some of its traditional tools to go after the more obvious nefarious actors in Syria, Iran, et cetera.
Were we doing anything in Syria before
this thing broke out? I think it was part of the same playbook, but I think what you've seen is a more aggressive attempt to isolate those individuals and front companies that have been used by the Syrian regime and the Iranians to support Assad in some of the atrocities we've seen. So the Treasury Department's done that. Where you've seen less activity, Leonard, and I think where there's some criticism to be had, is there's been less of a positive agenda, less of a sense that there is not just the ability to sanction, but the ability to support with financial tools and resources, in particular not just state actors, but non-state actors. And I think that's where the U.S. often sees a deficit in its policies.
You write about the 2006 New York Times reports on the U.S. government's terrorist finance tracking program and the transaction database of the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunications, so-called SWIFT. Right. Salon has an excerpt from that part of your book just recently. What was the Treasury Department doing?
Well, soon after 9/11, what we did was we approached SWIFT, the leadership of SWIFT, its board. SWIFT is, as you said, a messaging service, basically a bank messaging service for most of the banks of the world, overseen by 10 central banks, including the U.S. Fed. What we did was we approached SWIFT to say, we need your data. We're going to do this legally, and we're going to do this in a way that is respectful of privacy, civil liberties. And Leonard, importantly, and this is captured in the excerpt in Salon, we knew that this was going to become a public program at some point. We just knew it would at a certain point. And in fact, by 2006, when the New York Times called the Treasury Department, the question was, what took you so long, right?
But you also were aware that they only were sniffing around. They did not know the complete story.
They didn't, but they were doing a good job. These are great reporters, and you had the LA Times looking at it as well, Greg Miller and Josh Meyer, and others like Glenn Simpson from the Wall Street Journal, who were aware of contours of the program. So it was out there in a sense. The problem, though, in how it was revealed, Leonard, was it came after the NSA wiretap programs were revealed. And so there was a patina of illegitimacy, illegality, and sort of unwarranted intrusion that the New York Times, I think, brought to the story. And I think if you read my book and if you look in retrospect, this was actually a program that balanced quite well the need to look at mass amounts of data while constricting the government's use of it and retention of it. Because this is a program that not only subject to subpoenas, but has also been restricted more and more over time. It's given the company the right to oversee its use. It's been audited from the outside. The Europeans have audited it. So it's actually a fairly transparent way of doing this. And unfortunately, I think the New York Times treatment of the story didn't allow a debate about how you do this properly in 2006.
But isn't there a problem in the fact that the European Union and Belgium, where SWIFT is based, found EU privacy law had been violated, although you emphasize in the book that numerous U.S. officials found the program legal? So what happens if U.S. law says it's legal and European law says it's not?
Well, the first thing is the SWIFT lawyers go nuts because they get whipsawed, right? They get letters from European authorities saying you may have committed criminal acts.
By allowing the United States to
On the other hand, you get legitimate subpoenas from U.S. authorities backed by U.S. law, backed by U.S. precedent. Saying this is legal, and your U.S. lawyers are saying you've got to turn over the information. So there is a bit of a conflict, and it actually reveals a bit of the challenge with some of these financial regulatory rules and privacy rules, because the rules are sometimes different in different countries.
And then we have Representative Peter King of Long Island calling the Times reporting treasonous. Did you think any measures should have been taken against those reporters?
Well, I'm not sure about that, but I certainly didn't. I thought that the report was not helpful, and at the time I was upset, of course, because we thought, you know, this was an effective program. I give good examples of that in the book. It was legal. It was you know, being used the way we said it was being used, as being overseen, outside audits. So it didn't have all of the problems that the type of program like this would have. And the other thing I'd say, Leonard, is, you know, the ombudsman for the New York Times, the public editor, issued a mea culpa a few months after the publication of the story, saying he was wrong to have supported its publication. And I've heard lots of folks along the political spectrum say, you know what, New York Times probably made a mistake in this case.
My guest is Juan Zarate. His book, Treasury's War, The Unleashing of a New Era of Financial Warfare, published by Public Affairs. During the Bush administration, he was first assistant secretary of the Treasury for Terrorist Financing and Financial Crimes. And he is now a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, also a senior national security analyst for CBS News and a visiting lecturer of law at Harvard Law School. His book is published by Public Affairs. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You mentioned that the story came out around the same time that we were first learning about NSA surveillance. So how come you just didn't do what the NSA has done? Wouldn't that have made life easier for you? You could have kept it secret, put, you know.
Yeah. Well, we did try to keep
secret,
it classified.
It.
We had fun names for the program. In the Treasury Department, we called the program Turtle, the opposite of Swift. it was closely compartmentalized, but it was an unusual program because, again, we had a very cooperative relationship with Swift, its overseers, the central bankers. So this wasn't a classic intelligence program where spooks and spies were the only ones in on it. It was actually the financial community that was aware of this.
Is there an additional issue here of what are called administrative subpoenas that are issued by agencies rather than the courts?
Yes. I mean, that is an issue, although this has never been challenged, with a victory in this context. You have the Office of Foreign Assets Control, which administers all of the sanctions programs for the U.S. government, part of the Treasury Department, that does issue these subpoenas and can do so. And so, yes, you can make an argument that administrative subpoenas may be overbroad or may be overused. But they are certainly legitimate and have been upheld in U.S. courts for years.
Is the United States uniquely powerful in this area because it's such a financial powerhouse globally? The dollar being the currency, the international currency, really. Can any others wage financial warfare as the United States can? The EU, perhaps, or Russia, because it has so much power, at least over countries as an oil supplier?
Absolutely. And I get into this in the back end of the book, which is, you know, we're not the only ones who can play this game. And certainly we've taught others the lessons of both economic vulnerabilities and the tools.
I forgot to mention China.
And China, of course. And so what you see actually in China is an ongoing debate about a change in their policy, which is, can they use unilateral sanctions to effectuate their national security interests? You've seen glimmers of this with China. Their spat with Japan, some diplomatic rows that have turned into economic battles, refusing to, for example, export rare earth minerals, which are important to Japanese industries. And so that's already started happening. You've seen it with Russia, with supplies of oil and gas to, for example, the Ukraine. And you've certainly seen that in cases where countries have chafed at American power and have tried to find alternative ways around it. And so that's why you've started to see the Chinese currency start to form part of these bartering exchanges that are starting to undercut the strength of the dollar.
In a Washington Post story in 2006, Daphna Linzer commented that you and others in the Bush administration were, I'm quoting, the first set of American policymakers truly at home in a unipolar world. A world where the United States was the world's only superpower. Did that American power influence the government's approach?
I think it did. I think it did because in many ways our financial power was tethered to the power of the dollar, the preeminence of the American market, and also in a world that was looking for U.S. leadership. And so on all of these issues, it actually fell to the United States to drive solutions. And the U.S. was sort of both in a powerful position to do so, but also other countries were welcoming of it. And in many ways, Leonard, these issues were more comfortable for countries than harder issues like classic counterterrorism or weapons of mass destruction. the ability to say, look, we are all worried about the flow of illicit financing in the international financial system, and we have to isolate rogues from it, made it altogether more palatable and more effective at the end of the day when we went out internationally.
In a civil war of the sort that we're seeing in Syria, could both sides be engaging in financial warfare? Or would only the Assad regime have the real power?
Well, I think this also falls to a kind of a proxy battle, as we've seen. And I think you could have the major powers engaging in a real financial war. As you mentioned earlier in our conversation, you do have Russia and Iran serving as financial lifelines for the regime. And in some ways are providing a backstop economically and financially. You haven't seen as aggressive an approach on the other side. And there are certain things that could be done to ratchet up the pressure on Syria. Certainly there's been a lot of pressure to date, no question about that. But there are certain things that could be done both against Syria and their allies like the Russians and perhaps even Russian banks that could be effective.
Given the dependence of global finance on the internet, how is the possibility of cyber war changing the picture?
It's another great question. I think one of the interesting things we've seen over the last year and a half is that cyber warfare has shifted to financial cyber warfare. You've seen U.S. banks, U.K. banks come under an increased amount of pressure from Iranian proxies, perhaps even the Iranian regime. You've seen various viruses that have been attacking banking systems, for example, in Lebanon. Certainly you've seen economic targets like the Saudi oil infrastructure get attacked. And so the cyber warfare domain has started to shift financially. And it's interesting that the warning that was put out by the FBI just the other day with respect to Syria had in it a warning of cyber attacks potentially on financial institutions.
With chemical or biological warfare, there's the fear of spillover. The U.S.-Israeli engineered Stuxnet computer virus reportedly got out into the global network. Economists speak of financial contagion. Could financial attacks spill over as well?
I think so. I think there's a delicate balance here. Secretary Paulson, the former Secretary of the Treasury, called the system, sort of the international system, the great magnificent glass house. And you had to be very cautious and careful about how you use these tools. And I think that's one of the dangers here, that these tools have proven so effective and given us sort of a range of activities and things we can do between diplomacy and warfare, that it often becomes sort of the default tool of choice. And that becomes potentially dangerous because we could potentially overuse it, have others be less responsible in their use, and also at the same time destroy the essence of the international financial system.
I remember back in the late 1970s when the Hunt brothers tried to corner the world market in silver. There was a spike in silver prices for a while and then a crash. More recently, Goldman Sachs has been investigated for possible manipulation of the world aluminum prices. Does that suggest that private corporations, not just terrorists or organized crime, could present a financial threat?
Yes. And I think the admixture of those groups and companies is really dangerous. One of the things I get into in the book was our growing concern over transnational organized crime, and in particular from Eurasia and Russia, where you had seen over time very sophisticated financial networks grow up to not only engage in sort of the classic money laundering illicit activity, but also very legitimate financial activity, sort of blending corporate practice on the world stage with some of the illicit activities. And the difficulty of disentangling that and the danger that those types of organizations could use their corporate formations around the world to actually corner markets or to get access to markets in a way that's dangerous.
And then more recently, the Times ran a story just last month about the use of liens as a kind of financial terrorism here in the United States, especially by anti-government activists in the sovereign citizen movement. What impact can average individuals have on the modern financial environment?
Well, I think more and more in the age of the super-empowered individual, the more fluid ability to engage in financial practices, you have the ability of small groups and individuals to actually impact. And you see that in the cyber attack domain. You see it in the example you gave of the tax protesters now for a couple of decades using that tactic against government officials and their enemies.
They sue them for millions of dollars.
Yeah, and really tie up the system and these people's lives for years. And it really is a form of economic terrorism. But what you have is an age where, you know, somebody on the other side of the globe can access the financial system and can impact it in a way that really creates vulnerabilities. And I think one of the challenges for the U.S. is we have perhaps deeper vulnerabilities than any other country, given our dependence on the internet and dependence on the global system.
Juan C. Zarate, his book Treasury's War, The Unleashing of a New Era of Financial Warfare, published by Public Affairs. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you, Leonard. I appreciate it.